When you have a loved one with dementia, the practical and emotional demands can be overwhelming. What if you could be grounded and confident, embracing the journey, even when a loved one has dementia? This is Catherine Hammond, and together with my co-host Kent Matthews, let's explore how to do that here on A Thriving Life. Well, today we are so excited to be speaking with Roy Reamer. Roy has been an end-of-life caregiver and educator since 1997. Among other topics, he teaches mindful caregiver education. And he currently serves as the executive director of the Zen Hospice Project. So, welcome, Roy. Can you tell us a little bit about the Zen Hospice Project and your work there?
Sure. Hi, Catherine. It's wonderful to be with you today. Well, let's see. So, Zen Hospice Project has been around for about 32 years. And we really started off as a volunteer organization. And we trained volunteers to sit at the bedside of the dying. And we also, for many years, had a small residential care facility. And we ran that facility, and our volunteers served side by side with our staff nurses. And we've also gotten into the service of providing educational programs to the public based on our really successful volunteer training. And these courses are designed to support both clinical caregivers and family caregivers in the difficult role of taking care of people in this busy world. So we focus primarily on the emotional skills to support caregivers. So those are the areas of our business, if you will, these days. And our volunteers currently serve at the County Rehabilitation Hospital on their palliative care floor. There are 60 beds, and we have about 75 volunteers over there who are serving.
What an amazing project, being somebody who works with people who are planning for their eventual death and working with families around somebody's passing. Those are such important days and weeks and moments in somebody's life.
It's really a rich time. You know, they often will say that, you know, death can bring out the best and the worst in people. But what I have found, having been a volunteer caregiver for about 13 years before coming on the staff, that most of the time people are really at their best when they're held in an environment where people are meeting them with open hearts and clear attention. And it's a time for big reflection, and a lot of the smaller issues of life kind of fall away. And most of the people I've sat with, while there may be fear present for them, they're quite open and quite willing to explore what their life has been and, you know, celebrate the joy that they've had throughout their life and be really honest with themselves around some of the things that perhaps they regret. So as a volunteer, it feels like an absolute privilege to be able to sit with people at that point.
How powerful. And I'm wondering if you feel like there are things that come up in those hospice chapters of people's lives that end up bringing healing for things that have come before.
Absolutely. So I've often thought to myself that perhaps the greatest gift that a hospice volunteer can bring is just a listening ear and beyond that, perhaps even the ability to elicit story from the people who are living at the very end of their lives. And so a very natural process that we all go through at the end of life is this experience known as the life review. And so many times I've overheard volunteers in such a conversation, or I found myself in such a conversation where the person who's dying sees in the volunteer this opportunity, this opening to reflect upon the life that they've lived and to be held in the kind of space where they can be honest. Of course, it's not always fond memories. There can be extremely difficult things that come up for people, but there's something very powerful in the processing of those difficulties and the joys, those stories from one's life. And even if one isn't inclined or doesn't naturally process the experiences that they've had, just the telling of the story is a very, very potent way of preparing them to essentially leave those things behind for whatever's unfolding before them, either in the dying process itself or in the mystery of what lies beyond that final breath. So that's one of the things that our volunteers do. And I think in many ways, apart from just, you know, being companions, this is one of the greatest services that they can provide for someone at the very end.
I'm curious what your first exposure to caregiving was in your life, whether you knew it was caregiving at the time or whether you only figured it out later. Do you remember how you first experienced caregiving, either as a carer or receiving some sort of care?
Yeah, what a lovely question. Well, the first thought that comes to mind is being a care recipient, someone who received a lot of care. As a kid, I had some health issues. And so I just remember the way I was held in that space of caring and attention by both my mother and my father. And now that I think back on that experience, I can see the way that it really modeled for me effective and just supportive caregiving. And then the experience of being a carer, being a caregiver, what comes up for me is when my grandmother was nearing the end of her life, and, you know, the time I would spend with her. And, you know, one of the things we find is that a lot of people don't identify as a caregiver when they're caring for a family member. And I think at the time, the same was true for me. I was just a grandson who was quite fond of my grandmother, and so I would visit with her and I would help her around her place and just sit and listen to her. But as I think back on that time, I was very definitely a caregiver. And when she moved out of the area where I grew up at the very end of her life to be closer to her other daughter, my aunt, I was able to spend some time with her when she was ill and in the hospital, and just be that listening ear for her and ask her about her stories. And it was a very natural activity for me. At the time, I, you know, obviously didn't know what I know today, but this kind of storytelling, as I say, comes very naturally. So that was one of the things I did. At the time, I don't think I really applied the kind of practices we teach caregivers in our courses these days, namely, how to maintain that quality of presence and attention, that clear witnessing, or, you know, these practices of keeping their heart open, or, you know, the practices around understanding that whether it's chronic illness or terminal illness, there's loss that's taking place constantly. And I don't know how adept I was at holding that loss for her, but when I think back on that time, I have fond memories, despite how sad it was to see her dying and to see her suffering in the way she was. But, you know, those were the last experiences I had with my Bubby Sylvia, as we called her. Mm. And I would say, looking back on the arc of my process of coming into hospice work, I really attribute my involvement in this work to my grandmother and to those experiences. It really inspired me to explore a little more deeply this big topic of loss and death and dying.
I know, with thinking back to the days that I was primary caregiver for my mother, I have to give myself a lot of grace about what I didn't know back then. Mm-hmm. And it's part of what fuels what I do today. And it sounds like it's the same thing for you. Now, that was your first caregiving experience. You had no skills or training or idea even what it was, what she needed, what you needed. Is that part of what fuels you today?
Yeah, absolutely. We hear a lot of this where people will show up at our open death conversations and they arrive with a lot of regrets that they did certain things or they didn't do certain things that they would have done if they knew then what they know now. And the reframe that I'll sometimes offer is that, you know, how wonderful that this person who you sat with at the end of their life has, you know, gifted you with that experience from which, you know, you were able to learn and then begin to give that gift away to others who you may sit with now or in the future. And I often will look back on that experience and view it as just a necessary experience or time that I needed to go through to arrive in this place where I am today and to learn some really valuable lessons. And this is where I think the practice of self-compassion really comes in. You know, can we acknowledge that to be with someone who's suffering the way people do at the end of their lives or when they're dealing with intense illness is a really difficult thing to do? And like so many others out there in the world, you know, we show up and we simply do the best we can do. And that means we'll sometimes make mistakes. We may say things that in retrospect we wish we had not said, or we don't say things that we wish we had taken the opportunity to say. And so those are really rich and potent times whether we're stumbling our way through it for the first time or whether we've had some experience in it and we're able to show up with a bit more grace. But I often am thinking back to my grandmother and really feeling this deep sense of gratitude that I had that experience with her, and it led me to this place today.
Mm. You teach mindful caregiver education.
Tell
me about that. What exactly is mindful caregiving?
Well, mindful caregiving, I would say, is a focus on our emotional well-being and in the emotional skills that are required to show up fully, to show up in a way that is of the greatest benefit to ourselves as a caregiver, but to the one whom we're serving, the one whom we're caring for. And so, you know, there are a lot of caregiver educational programs that wonderfully focus on what I would describe as the hard skills, you know, for instance, how to administer certain medications, how to work with body mechanics to stay safe and transferring someone from a bed to a wheelchair, for instance, how to make sure you're following universal precautions so that you're not subject to contagions, or bacteria, this sort of thing. But that's not what we offer. Those are really important things and necessary. But what we have found is that the greatest value that we bring based on our long experience is to offer these teachings that support the emotional well-being of caregivers. So as you probably are quite familiar with, you know, there are so many family caregivers out there. The AARP did a study a few years ago, and at the time, they told us that there were 43 million family caregivers across the country. And most of these people are not very well prepared for the emotional strain and burden that comes from being a family caregiver. And this isn't always the case. Often, depending on the acuity of the person they're caring for, someone can have a really positive and easy experience of being a caregiver. But often, it's also true that family caregivers are suffering greatly in the role. They're stressed out. They're having a difficult time taking care of themselves. And so the skills that we're teaching show practices that support well-being from an emotional place. So we focus on four different areas. And the first area is really the practice of mindfulness. So how to stay grounded and centered in the moment. So how to minimize distractions. And this really helps the caregiver in their own well-being, but it also helps the care recipient because it's lovely to be the focus of one's undistracted attention. I think we all know what that feels like.
It's the best feeling in the world.
So we're offering different practices and techniques to help them develop that kind of presence. And then the second area are these practices around cultivating an open heart or compassion. And this can be really difficult for family caregivers. There may be a lot of past experiences that get in the way. And certain patterns begin to play out. So we're providing tools so that people can not just stay present, but keep their hearts open, not just to the care recipient or the person around them, but to themselves as well. Self-compassion plays a big role in what we teach. And then the third area, I'd like to call this death education or death intelligence. And this is really around supporting the caregivers on how to hold the experience of loss that's ongoing, both for themselves as a caregiver, but for the one they're caring for. It's constant, this process of losing things, losing opportunities, losing potential. So we have a number of exercises that we engage the caregivers in so that they have an opportunity to see what emotions arise for them as they're contemplating the different types of loss that they experience or will experience at some point in their caregiver role or in their life. And so we want to provide them with an opportunity to create more intimacy with their emotional response so that they're familiar with it when it arises in the role. And then finally, the area we focus on is what I generally refer to as self-care. So we're just trying to support people to find very simple, achievable changes in their lifestyle that will sustain them in the role of caregiver over the long term. So that's a little bit about what we teach and what I think of when I think of mindful caregiving.
And what kind of difference do you see for caregivers when they come to you versus once they've gone through the mindful caregiver education? Are there some common themes about things that change for them?
Well, I think the biggest thing I notice is that people will leave with this sense of hope. And I've seen so many family caregivers come into our courses in this state of just intense overwhelm and hopelessness. And the role is, well, there's a sense that the role is really destroying them. It sounds dramatic, but I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that. People are coming in and they've had a really hard time and they have some real questions around how they can survive being in this role. So I feel like what we do in our courses is we're providing a lifeline for people. And so there are some of the areas where I notice real change is that while family caregiving can often be very isolating, people are so busy often, and it's not uncommon for people to self-isolate and not want to reach out to friends and family for support or companionship. So because these courses are offered in community, in groups of other family caregivers, people achieve a great sense of community, and they feel like they're not so alone in the role. And that's really beautiful to witness, to see people connect in this way. And then people leave feeling much more grounded and relaxed. We're teaching skills, but really we're trying to create an experience where people can relax into each unfolding moment and get some real rest for themselves. It's a respite, but it's also, people have described our courses as being like a retreat, a meditation retreat, because we're constantly reminding people just to stay present and just focus on what's in front of them. Then there's the quality of respite. You know, they just get a break from the role itself. And this is a really important piece. And then finally, I would say people leave with a big reframe of the role of family caregiver. And so we'll help people see that really what's in front of them, while challenging and often straining and burdensome, there really is an opportunity for them to grow as a human being in the role, because they're learning so much about themselves and they're learning so much about just the nature of life, you know, a life where we all, if we're lucky, you know, live to an old age and we'll get sick. And so this reframe has, in my observation, has been a really important piece. And it's not just a reframe of the role for their own sake, but we help people see that, you know, they have family, friends who too will someday be in the role of family caregiver. And these people pay attention. And so, you know, we can find ourselves in the role of mentor or model, if you will. And the way we show up for caregiving can be a great inspiration for others who will also someday be in that role.
And it seems like most of us end up being in that role in some way at some point.
Sooner or later.
Right.
I think so.
If the best case scenario in life is that we get to an old age and then get sick and die, or just die, there's a lot of caregiving going on.
That's right. And, you know, for a lot of us, it can be difficult to be the recipient of care. You know, we live in a culture where self-reliance is, you know, so emphasized, and there's such great value placed upon that. And so I think when we're in the role of caregiver, we're learning from the one we're caring for about, you know, what it means to receive care. And, you know, actually, it can be a great gift to our loved ones to receive care, as you say, with grace. I think, really useful for caregivers to have an opportunity to step back and recalibrate the role, even if that means getting really clear on certain boundaries that they need to establish to stay in the role for the long term. And this is one of the things when we poll family caregivers, boundaries is one of the big issues that comes up for them.
I want to come back to something that you had mentioned a couple of minutes ago. You mm-hmm. talked about the near constant loss that we're facing as caregivers. What are some of the keys to dealing with loss as a caregiver?
Well, I think maybe the most important is just to remind ourselves of the inevitability of loss. And, you know, it's interesting, over the years, you know, we've really looked at how do we invite conversations around death and dying. And let's face it, you know, most of us don't really want to talk about death and dying. But it's rare that I meet someone who isn't interested in talking about life transitions or, you know, the big passages that we've experienced in our life. And with every big passage that we experience, you know, there is some loss. And so looking at the lesser losses in life offers an opportunity to, you know, venture into the bigger conversation around death and dying. So, you know, in our classes, we'll often invite people to just think about, in the role of caregiver, you know, what have you lost? What has your experience of loss been like? And, you know, so often people will talk about the loss of freedom, you know, the loss of free time, for instance, the loss of opportunity to do certain things in their life that they thought they would be doing, but they are unable to because of the requirements of the role of being a family caregiver. People talk about the lost dreams of doing certain things with their loved one who they're now caring for. So I think it's a combination of really acknowledging the universality of loss and recognizing that this is simply what it means to be human. And then looking at, you know, what are the emotions that come up for me around loss? You know, for some of us, it's sadness. For some, it may be anger. Others, it could be confusion. But to create the kind of intimacy with those emotional responses so they're not debilitating when they arise, or they don't control us, but rather we can recognize them, acknowledge them, and respond rather than react when these emotions come up.
Oh, I was just going to say that takes a tremendous amount of the groundedness and centeredness to be able to respond rather than react.
Yeah, it's true. And I appreciate you saying that because, you know, it's important to recognize that these, there's a reason why we call these teachings practices, because it does take a lot of practice. And we will have basically 16 hours over a weekend. Typically, our courses are 2 days in a row. And that's not enough to establish a practice. And so when the caregivers leave us, we're providing them with tools so they can begin to integrate these practices into their life if they choose to. And it's not easy to do because, as I've mentioned a couple times, so often family caregivers are really busy. But it's almost like we can prescribe the medication, but then it's up to the caregiver to take it or not. And so these practices that we teach, while they're based on, you know, 2,500-year-old spiritual traditions, a number of different traditions, we kind of repackage them so that they're very contemporary and secular and easily integrated into one's life. And we've discovered that's a really important thing for us to be doing. We want them to be really practical.
And when you say that they're secular, does that mean that I don't have to be a practitioner of Zen Buddhism in order to come to one of your classes or benefit from
That's
your classes?
Right. Yeah. Yes. So I would say that every religious or spiritual tradition throughout time or from around the world has a contemplative practice of some sort. And I think there's a lot of similarity in these different practices. And so, it just so happens we were founded over at the San Francisco Zen Center. And so we were inspired by that particular tradition. And Soto Zen Buddhism happens to be my practice, but we've really done a lot of work to make these practices as universally acceptable as possible. And I think we've done a good job of that. The language we use, the way we teach the practices, I think they've been welcomed or accepted by people from all different traditions.
There's something else that I wanted to ask you about. You talk about the conversations that we need to have with our loved ones when there's a terminal diagnosis or situation. What kinds of conversations should we be having with our loved ones?
Yes, well, I think of a story of a friend of mine. Her father suffered a massive stroke, and when she flew back to the Cincinnati area to be with him from the West Coast, when she arrives in the ICU and she saw her father on life support, this was, of course, a shocking and tragic moment for her. But as she, sat at the bedside with her sister, they knew exactly what their father wanted for himself. And so when I think of that situation where she instructed the medical team to take her father off life support, she was following his wishes. She was following his instructions that were very clear. And she knew this because they were able to have these conversations around what he wanted for himself when his time came, whatever the situation might be. And so this, I think it's fair to say, fits with my friend as this really beautiful gift that her father gave to her, that kind of clarity around what he wanted. So he didn't burden them with having to make a choice or to try to anticipate or think of what he would want for himself. And so these are the kind of conversations I think are really important, really worthwhile. They bring us closer together with our loved ones. And I think each of us would want to alleviate the burden from our loved ones of having to decide what they think is best. And these are difficult conversations, but they can be really rich conversations full of, good emotions and full of ways of looking at the preciousness and beauty of life. And so I really encourage, whether you're in the role of caregiver or not, I really encourage people to invite family members into a conversation around, what are one's attitudes towards one's own death? And what do you want your death to be like? And we never know what we're going to get. But to me, it doesn't really matter so much what kind of death we end up having, because death is just a topic that can bring us into a really rich and beautiful conversation with the people we care about. And, sometimes family members are not the right people to invite the conversations. You know, children may not be the best ones to try to engage a parent in such a conversation. So if that's the case, then I think it becomes really important to find someone in one's extended community who is comfortable holding such a conversation. And I've come to believe that while there's an assumption that, you know, death is this taboo topic, people really do want to talk about it. They want to bring it out into the light of day and explore what it means to, you know, plan for a good death. And that's totally subjective. There's no one good way of dying out there. It really depends on the person. But, you know, it's this beautiful way of talking about life and acknowledging the preciousness of each moment that we have by being willing to talk about death and dying.
What if someone has dementia? How does that affect the timing of having these conversations?
Yeah, great question. I think about this a lot these days. As more and more caregivers come to us supporting someone living with a dementia diagnosis. And so I think there, for me, there's a greater urgency to invite these conversations. I'm afraid all too often, especially for family members of one who's living with a dementia diagnosis, there's this sense that, well, there's still time to have the conversation. I don't have to have it now. I don't need to take a chance of alienating or scaring my loved one. You know, they may slip into confusion and the inability to remember things, but then they come back. So there's time. And then before we know it, we lose this opportunity. And it's a real loss for the families of the person with dementia, but it's a loss for that person as well. So I think the kinds of conversations we want to invite regarding actual physical demise are the conversations we really should be having with people who have early stage dementia diagnosis. And yeah, I mean, for me, it's there's a nice template or map, if you will, for these conversations. And you know, I think the best way into it is just to acknowledge that something is changing, that there is impermanence in this life that we're living, and there is a loss that's taking place. And then to venture into the relationships that the person has had throughout their life and explore, you know, is there unfinished business with anyone in particular? If you could go back and do something over, what would you do? And what would you say to this person or to these people who have played a part in your life? To really clean up some of the relationship business that needs cleaning up. And I'm making it sound really nice and tidy, and these are complicated conversations, but really just a focus on relationships. And then one is freed up to focus on the life that they've lived, their own personal experience of living, and to celebrate the successes and the beauty of the life that they've lived, and also to come to peace with one's own failings. And in this way, we begin to, you know, loosen the attachment we have to the life that's been lived. And then the fourth part of the conversation, I think, is around, so, you know, under ideal circumstances for you, what would you want your death to look like, and how do you want to be remembered, and what kind of memorializing would you want for your loved ones after you go? And that's pretty complete in terms of, I think, the things to be considered. You know, there are other issues that are practical, legal, and those need to be addressed as well. But I think I always find it a little unfortunate when people have the legal, financial conversations without having an opportunity to have the emotional, spiritual conversations. And I think all too often that's the case.
I couldn't agree more. And it's a little bit frustrating for me, being the estate planning attorney, having the legal and financial conversations and not having the time or space or opening to go deeper, particularly with people where I know that they don't have a place or a space to go deeper. And that's one of the things that's on my heart these days, is how do I help create that space for people in my
that's
sphere
great.
Of influence?
Yeah, it's important work. I'm so happy you're focused on that. You know, the whether it's the attorneys or people who have been trained in facilitating conversations around advanced medical directives or, you know, estate planning, all too often they haven't received the kind of training that I think is really useful to hold space for the emotional content that is often, you know, triggered by those considerations.
Right.
Yeah, so good work. Yeah.
So we're going to close with this, my favorite question, which is, even the hardest things in life bring us gifts. And you and I have talked about that just a little bit previously. Tell me about a gift that you've received, either through caregiving or through any challenge in your own life.
That's a beautiful question. Well, I've been very intrigued by this idea lately of a purpose-inspired death. And so I've received so many gifts from the people whose bedsides I've sat at as they've died. You know, they really have been my teachers. Sometimes I learn from them by watching things that I don't want for myself, and sometimes I learn from them by seeing things that I hope I can experience, you know, when my final moments come, my final days. But the real gift that I've received is just this recognition that none of us who are living and relatively healthy know how to die. And so in that final sacred act of dying, there is this gift to be given away. And so I've just recognized the importance of just considering for oneself an intention in our dying experience. And again, none of us knows how we will die, but I think the intention itself is a really, really useful thing to carry with us throughout life. You know, so what is my intention for my own death so that it offers something for the people around me, the people in my community that will somehow support them or benefit them as they too someday approach the end of their life? So it's a very reciprocal kind of relationship I find I've had with these people who have whose deaths I've witnessed. I'm there to support them, but they're giving something back to me. And when my time comes, I hope to be able to give something to those people who are witnessing me from near or far. And yeah, so that's kind of what comes up for me.
Based on our conversation, I have absolutely no question that you will do that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you wanted to share or any parting words of wisdom?
Well, let's see. I guess I would say, I just want to encourage your listeners to find whatever support they may need, whether it's around having a conversation about death and dying or support around being a caregiver, whether it's a clinical caregiver or a family caregiver. There really are ways to stay healthy in the role over a long period of time. And I'm just grateful for people listening. It's not an easy topic, but a worthy topic, to be sure. And I'm just grateful to all my teachers in this work, and I'm really happy to have had this conversation with you, Catherine, and I'm grateful for the work that you're doing. So thank you very much.
What a joy to talk to you. Hey, how can people find you?
Well, the easiest way is zenhospice.org, and we're a small nonprofit with really big plans to contribute to positive social change in these areas. And please visit us at our website, and you can sign up for our mailing list or Facebook feed. And don't hesitate to reach out to me. I do my best to communicate with anyone who sends an email.
And again, your mindful caregiver courses are open to the general public. And I would really recommend that listeners go online and check out zenhospice.org. There's so much information there, and you all have so many resources that will bless people, whether you go out and experience the education in person or whether you just take advantage of what they have on the internet.
So, that's right. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Roy. Mm-hmm.